You are very welcome to Bookish, a monthly books podcast from Dublin in Ireland, brought to you by the Headstuff Podcast Network. I'm Bob Johnston, the owner of the Gutter Bookshop in Temple Bar and Dalkey.
I'm Margaret Madden. I'm a book blogger at bleachhouselibrary.ie and I review some books for publications as well.
So you're very welcome back to Bookish under Headstuff. We're having a whole new relaunch here. You can listen to us online at headstuff.org and you can also subscribe on iTunes or on Android. For those of you who haven't come across Bookish before, we're talking sort of book news around Ireland. We'll talk about a book club pick, which we'll pick this month and discuss next month once we've both had a chance to read it. We have a guest slot called Trilogy, where we invite a special guest in to talk to us about three books that they've either loved or that they can't stop talking about, or they just want to rattle on about for a bit. We have a second look, which is rediscovering an old classic that maybe got lost along the way somewhere. And then we'll have a roundup of some new books that we're particularly looking forward to and some book events and other things going on for August. So first up, we kind of talk about maybe about some book news. So Margaret, you're actually just back from Harrogate.
Yeah,
Crime Festival.
Absolutely. It's the Theakston's Old Peculiar Crime Writing Festival. And it's on every year. I think it's 13th or 14th year. And this is my second year going. It's just fantastic. It's absolutely amazing.
I've never made it over, actually. Yeah.
It's 4 days. Now, I just go on the Friday. It's impossible trying to organise everything. So Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And it's just, there's over, I have it written down here somewhere, there's over 80 authors. And we're talking big, big names right down to just brand new blood. And there's panels running all day. It's all held in the same area, which is the Old Swan Hotel. And the authors just mix with the readers. And there's no pretentiousness. There's no separation.
A lot of excited crime fans, I should imagine.
Oh, my God, it's amazing. Yeah, the atmosphere is electric. Well worth going to.
And who was the highlight? Who was the one that blew you away?
The big name this year was Lee Child. So he was over to receive his kind of, I don't know, you call them Lifetime Achievement Awards, really, don't you, when you've written so many books as he has. And he was fantastic. And every year you have Val McDermott, Mark Billingham, Ellie Griffiths was hosting. There was just so many. Myself and other members from writing.ie went to different panels. We didn't go to all of them together. Mm. We kind of flipped over and took turns. So it was great. We kind of got to see everybody we wanted to see.
Yeah, you slipped in there as well. You also were one of the contributors to writing.ie,
yes,
which is the online writing,
yes,
website for people in Ireland. So do you now have to file kind of columns and stuff?
Yeah, well, I've been reviewing for writing.ie, run by Vanessa Fox O'Loughlin for a while, and now we just kind of file copy of what we've experienced, and we have so much fun. So it's actually fun even writing the articles, you know. It's great. I love it.
So a weekend away, just climbing away.
The highlight of my year. Well, that and the Irish Book Awards. Yeah.
Okay, so that is the Crime Festival. What else have we got going on? The Man Booker long list was announced this morning. Have you had a chance? Have you had a look at it?
I did. I had a look. I thought it was a really interesting list this year. There's, two... Irish.
That's it. There's the Sebastian Barry, mm-hmm, isn't there? Days Without End. And then I suppose the big news is the Mike McCormack, Solar Bones, which is an interesting one, I think, in itself, because Solar Bones wasn't eligible because it was published by Tramp Press in Ireland. But they then sold rights to publish in the UK to Canongate, who published it, I think it was last month, so May. And now because it was published in the UK.
Yeah, it was cutting it fine, but it was perfect timing, wasn't
it?
Exactly,
is now available to be in the Man Booker Prize, which is, I know there was a big piece Tramp Press wrote last year about the fact that, you know, obviously Irish publishers should be able to submit for the Man Booker Prize.
Yeah, the eligibility part of it is a little bit kind of, I don't know, it's a little bit off at the moment. Maybe they could look at that.
Yeah, I think it's difficult. I think the point of the article was very much around the idea. It's very difficult where Irish publishers obviously sell into the UK market anyway. So the book was available, Solar Bones. It won the Goldsmiths Prize over in the UK when it was just published by Tramp Press. But because it wasn't published in the UK or in the US, which I think
it's like
is the way,
slight technicality that must be absolutely
frustrating. And it's very different because of it's for people who don't know, the whole rights thing's very interesting because normally you sell the rights for the UK and Ireland together
as we're lumped as a group.
So therefore, if you publish it in Ireland to start with, it's very difficult then to sell the rights just into the UK because the market's normally the same market.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
So it's a little tweaking that happens, but it's fantastic to see Mike McCormack on there. It was one of my favourite books of last year when it was published by Tramp Press. And, you know, I think it deserves really to be picked up and lauded. So
the recognition is amazing.
Yeah.
It just means that his name is going to be just on the tip of everybody's lips.
I know.
The book
we're there, the Irish people there cheering, waving our flags.
It's the hashtag Irish fiction, isn't it?
Exactly.
And the ones I'm really looking forward to, I picked three. Was History of Wolves by Emily Friedland. She's from the US. Reservoir 13 by John McGregor, UK. And The Underground Railway, which I have, but I just haven't got around to reading it, also from the US. So that's Colson Whitehead.
Yes, I can say I've read two of those out of the three. I've read the John McGregor and the Colson Whitehead, both of which I loved, it has to be said, and both of which I think really deserve to be on that list.
They're well worth spending my money on.
The History of Wolves wasn't even on my radar until today. So it was fantastic. You know, there's always stuff that comes out. And there's also one that's worth mentioning, I think, which is actually written by the Fiona Moseley Elmet, it's called, which again wasn't on my radar. It's not yet published. It was due out, I think, in October, November. I think they've just moved it back to August today because they've said we need to capitalise on Man Book Prize.
Well, you're going to be lambasted now with people coming into the shop saying, have you got that one?
Have you got that one?
List?
Have you got that one?
You're like, not till November. Yeah. And then they'll forget about
it. But they tend to then suddenly bring it forward. But she was actually, and I don't know if she still is, she was actually a bookseller. She was working in a bookshop while she wrote the novel. And it's her debut, and it's I think it's a small press. So it's amazing, you know, just to
all
see
right,
it.
All right, Bob, I might just pencil that in onto
exactly,
my list.
Exactly, add that one to your list. So the Man Booker Prize long list, always a good sign. Any early dips on a winner? I never do, so this is why I'm asking you, because I never have a clue.
Well, I haven't read them all, so it's very hard to say.
Oh, don't let that in your
way. And I can't admit that, really, can I? Well, I just have. I'd like to see Mike given a chance.
Yeah.
I really would.
Yeah.
There seems to be good competition in there.
Yes. No, it'll be an interesting one. The shortlist is out on the 13th of September. So we've got a couple of months of the long list to play with. 13 titles on the long list.
Okay.
And then it's narrowed down to, I can't remember if it's five or six on the shortlist. Let's say that.
Ooh, so the excitement.
Always good to see.
Yeah.
Anything else triggering your fancy?
No, I was just thinking briefly last night about bookish things that I wanted to talk about, and the movie book adaptation thing is kind of really come to the foreground with the Margaret Atwoods and the Handmaid's Tale, and I just thought it might be nice to mention some other ones that are coming up, and the one that I was watching the trailers of, which I'm going to have to admit now, I haven't read Agatha Christie ever before.
Never read an
I know,
Agatha Christie.
I'm just back from the Old Swan Hotel in Harrogate, where she, you know, hid herself for months, years and years ago, and I've never read one. So Murder on the Orient Express is the big one coming out now in November. What a bloody cast as well.
Yes.
Absolutely phenomenal. I'm looking forward to that. So that was just something that crossed my mind last night.
Yeah, it's always interesting. As bookish people, I think we always say, always read the book first. Always read the book first. Because then whatever they do with the film or the series, you know, you have the book. I always think, and especially I think with a crime book, is always that kind of thing.
Yeah.
If they make a complete hash of the TV or
that
the film or whatever.
That worries me about the Joe Nesbo one now. Yeah. That's coming out now, The Snowman. That was another one I watched the trailer for last night. And I don't know, I remember the book and being, he was new to me. It was very exciting. And I'm watching the trailer and I'm thinking, there's an awful lot of people jumping out of shadows and clanging music and everything. So will it be one of these things? Don't judge the book by the movie.
Yes.
I don't know.
Yeah. Always read the book. That's all I'm saying. Just always read the book. And then if you see the film,
the other one then is for the kids that's coming up, but I'd say it'll be more the adults will watch the movie, is The Wonder by R.J. Palacio. I've watched the trailer for that last night, and again, I think it would be wonderful if the kids read the book first before the movie, but I doubt that's going to happen. I know. They like the movie first and then the book,
yes,
it seems to be.
I say, whichever way you come to Wonder, though, I think it's going to be
absolutely
fantastic experience.
So they're what I'm looking forward to.
Very good. Well, actually, kind of on a slightly related note, I think the big news from a couple of days ago was that George R. R. Martin has finally said that he's nearly finished the next Game of Thrones book, which is apparently called Winds of Winter, which made me laugh for some reason when I read it. But Winds of Winter it is. He's saying he's nearing the end of it and it should be out next year in 2018. There was something he's also written to histories, fictional histories tying into the Game of Thrones series. But this is the actual next new book. And it's going to be interesting because for people who have been watching the TV series, which I must admit I never have
me
seen
neither,
any of the TV.
I'm afraid.
Yeah. Is that obviously the TV went on further than the books and has taken it in their own direction without George R. R. Martin actually saying if this is where the plot of his books are going to go. So at this point you could see a big divergent between where the TV's taken. You can have characters that die in the books that are still alive on TV and vice versa. So
do they sign over the rights to that? Do they sign over to these TV companies that they can change the endings?
I think that was the agreement. I think the agreement is you do what is its own entity now. You do what you want with it and I'll carry on writing my books in a slow and methodical way.
With the cash in my pocket.
With exactly, you know, and see what comes. So I must admit, again, I read the first Game of Thrones book. I thoroughly enjoyed the first Game of Thrones book. It was very good. I personally, it wasn't, you know, something I wanted to keep reading the whole series. And especially, I think it's one of those where, you know, if the series isn't finished, then there's chances are that you're going to end up, like all the others, waiting impatiently for the next book to come out. So I'm always one of those that prefers a series to finish before I even start it.
Right,
so at least you know you've got a...
The frustration isn't there then.
You're not going to be banging your head off a wall. So, but there you are. A new Game of Thrones book is finally on the way for all the fans. Moving on from news, our next slot is our... It's normally our book club slot, but... We're here, we're new, we don't have anything to discuss this month, but I have tasked you with choosing our very first book club pick for the Bookish Book Club. So what did you come up with?
Okay, well, we wanted to make sure that it was something that's in the shops, and it's always nice to have something Irish. So I went for something that I actually have been meaning to read for a long, long time.
Always
you can
good.
Hear the paper rustling there because I brought it with me. And it is Nine Fools Make a Paper Swan by Irish writer Ruth Gilligan.
Oh, yes. Yeah, actually one, again, that I've always been meaning to read but haven't actually got to as yet, so...
Right. Well, I haven't read it, so I can't talk about it too much. So just having a quick dip into the blurb, basically it's there's three main characters, I think, over kind of spreading over a couple of generations. There's a family that were intending to emigrate to America, but somehow landed in Ireland. So this is back in the 20th century. So that's kind of the first thread. The next seems to be in the late 50s of a young mute boy who befriends an unlikely friend, basically, in a Dublin mental institution. And then the third thread is present day London. And it's an Irish journalist coming to terms with her own identity and family when a Jewish boyfriend asks her to make a huge leap of faith.
Mm.
So three voices spanning generations. It kind of looked good to me. Give it a lash.
Yeah, I've heard wonderful things. And saying one that I've been meaning to pick up, haven't got to it. Ruth Gilligan, I think she's a young Irish writer.
She is. I think she may actually have been a journalist herself or is. And I remember, again, the reviews were amazing when it came out first. It's now in the small form paperback as well, which makes it nice and accessible. So we'll give that a lash this month and see how we get on.
Yeah, exactly. We'll have a chat about that at next month's Bookish. Anybody who has opinions or wants to let us know or just get in contact with Bookish, we are on Twitter. We're at Bookish Podcast on Twitter. So do let us know what you think of our book club choice, Nine Folds Make a Paper Swan by Ruth Gilligan, if you read it or if you intend to read it, or even perhaps possibly if you don't have any intention of reading it, but I'm not sure what you'd have to tell us, but feel free to get
like
in
to
touch.
Get an L tweet.
Exactly. And exactly. Anything else you want to tweet us, you know, do get in contact at Bookish Podcast on Twitter. So our first guest slot of the new Bookish. It's always, I always say this is the highlight of the podcast, and that was always like, it's not us talking, which always makes it sound really good. But we are delighted to welcome our first guest to the relaunched Bookish podcast for our trilogy slot. So Tara Sparling, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tara is, you correct me if I'm wrong on this, because I did the usual thing of quick, what do I need to say about Tara? So Tara is a writer of fiction and of screenplays, but she's also a blogger, and she blogs about the book market and the book industry. Her blog, TaraSparlingWrites.com, that's correct, isn't
yes.
it?
Indeed. Very imaginative name.
Well, no, there yeah. you are, exactly. The best name is always your own.
It does what it says on the
exactly,
tin, yeah.
There you are.
Yeah.
But you recently won Funniest Blog at the annual Bloggers Bash Awards. I nearly said that one. The ABBAs, is
the
that
ABBAs,
right?
Yeah, there London.
You are.
Yeah.
So no pressure or anything.
No, no pressure. Anytime anybody introduces me like this, you know, it says, okay, so tell me a joke immediately. Yeah.
And it never works like that. But you, no, exactly. But how long have you been doing the blog?
Been doing the blog 4 years, just over 4 years now. And when I started it, I didn't know it was going to turn into comedy. But when I sit down and write nonfiction, it comes out as satire. And that was as much of a surprise to me as anybody else. So, yeah, I write satire about books, which is weird because, you know, you're not
it's
writing
a niche market.
Books.
Well, it's not a niche yeah. market. You seem yeah. to have a great following and you always seem to get a great response to it. Why do you think it works? Why do you think?
I think it's because there's a lot that you know, one thing that connects every story that's told is a certain amount of cliches and stereotypes. And I don't think you can make fun out of anything that you don't love. If you don't love it, it's going to come out as bitter and it's just not going to be funny. But when you love something as much as book lovers do, when people make fun of things like cliche and stereotype and the characters that keep cropping up and the genre stereotypes that everybody conforms to, it's like everybody's in on the joke.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably why it works, because we can all recognise it when we all read, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, we've spoken on the blog and kind of via Facebook and things and things that come up. I think the thing that works for me, and I think a lot of bookish type people really appreciate, is that you don't beat around the bush, that you actually just say it as you see it. And you're willing to, you know, you get into then conversations with people about possibly things that people agree with, people things don't agree with.
And trouble. Don't forget the trouble.
Yeah. There's always a bit of trouble, exactly. Yeah.
But it does unleash the beast sometimes too, doesn't it?
You've it got, does, yeah. because I think I speak very generally. It's a weird thing to talk about the book industry from a reader's perspective. A lot of what I write about is what things that happen in the book industry mean for us, the readers, the people who are, you know, always on the lookout for the new thing, or what is the new thing. And if there is going to be a very popular trend or a thing that seems to be happening over and over again, an imitation, what does that really mean for us readers who are constantly looking for something to blow us away? But I think sometimes when you point out things like that, people can take it very personally. They think you're speaking just to them or about them. When in actual fact, I wouldn't say anything unless I saw an overriding trend going on quite a lot.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because obviously as an industry outsider, sometimes you forget how a reader sees things. And it's the most important thing, because that's what we're there to do. We're there to give books to readers. So, you know, that's where it should come from. And I think, as in all kind of businesses and all kind of industries, sometimes you're so busy staring at your own navel, you forget to stare at anybody else's.
And that's where I'm here to stare at everybody's navel and pick the lint out of it.
Tara Sparling, navel gazer. There
that's
we
it.
Are.
Yes, and lint picker.
Lint picker, very good. So our trilogy slot on Bookish Podcast, what we asked is somebody to come in and basically just tell us about three books, any three books. They could be books that inspired you. They could be books that just have always stayed with you. They could just be three random books you found when on your way here when you ran out of time. But what have you got for us today?
The three books, the common theme of the three books that I've brought in today are that
a theme.
I don't know what these are, but I'm really excited.
Are that these are books that I have bought several copies of. And they're great for booksellers, but not for me, because I keep either buying them as presents or more often I lend them to people and they don't give them back.
Yes.
So they're all on my list. you know, of people whose lives are going to be very interesting when I am president of the world. But one of them I haven't even got to bring in with me today, because that was one that I loaned but never got back.
Never seen.
And that was the second copy of that one that I've bought. Mm. So all of these books today are books that I loved so dearly that I desperately wanted other people to read them enough to give them away and run the risk of not getting them back and putting them on my list. No matter how much I love
those
people.
See, as a bookseller, this all sounds fantastic.
Yeah,
there you are.
Yeah.
Sell every book three times for me. That's
exactly.
Better. There we are.
Exactly. You just need to narrow down your list of people that you will ever lend a book to now, if they're not going to give them back.
Yeah.
Like, see, I have a thing at home, which is that I love lending books out because it clears a space on the shelf that I can fill with something else that I haven't got yet, if you see what I mean. But it does exactly the same thing. You know, you'll be coming into something like this and you go, I've got a copy of that somewhere. Yeah. Where have I got that? Yeah. And you went, oh, I lent that to Maeve.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I lent that to, you know, like...
Oh. You see, this is the thing. Some books, you know, people just say, can you give me something to read? And it's fine. I'll run my hand along the shelf. I'll give them something. I never want to see it again. It's fine.
Mm.
But these are the ones that when they're not on the shelf, they're missing.
Yeah.
And the first one that I am genuinely missing, because I don't even have a copy right now, so I'm going to have to go back to a shop and get it.
Sounds
good. I wonder where you would find.
Is a book called A Fraction of the Whole by Steve Taltz.
Yes.
One of my favourite books of all time. And Steve Taltz is an Australian author. And I think after he wrote this book, he didn't have another one out for about seven years. And he had one of those dry spells. And there were an awful lot of newspaper articles written about him not having a new book out. As far as I was concerned, leave the man alone. He wrote a masterpiece. Just leave him alone. And it does feel like you're overselling something. But as somebody who writes comedy, as opposed to performing it, you know, on cue. But as somebody who writes comedy, I find that fiction, it's almost impossible to make fiction funny. People will tell you that fiction is funny when it's not really. And you stand back from a lot of fiction which is supposed to be funny, especially the prize winning stuff.
Mm.
And not to name any names, but there are two books that are constantly in my head when I think of fiction which is supposed to be funny and isn't. And everybody says that they're hilarious, but I find myself standing outside it almost like an analyst going, oh, yes, I can see that this is technically supposed to be funny. Or, oh, yes, I can see that this storyline is definitely coming to the comedy part because his leg has just fallen off. But I'm not laughing.
Yeah.
And I'm not even
smiling. That's always the key, isn't it? It's a funny book if
it makes
you laugh.
So why was this one so funny, do you think?
This one was funny, I think, because it felt like the characters were genuinely writing it. The narrative voice is in it. Jasper, the main character who starts off in a prison. We don't know why. We don't know what he's done. And he says that he's going to start writing the story of his life from prison because there's nothing else to do. And he doesn't really want to get involved in the constant rioting and other things that he just sees as annoyances.
Or free law degrees or any of that.
Yeah, exactly. So he starts to write the story of his life and it becomes apparent that he is a very unusual family. And a very unusual relationship with his father, who was in himself a very unusual man. And this is one of the things where Steve Taltz broke all of my rules, where I'm not interested in the sort of television or literature that is obsessed with father-son relationships. Because an awful lot of things that came out of America for a long time seemed to be obsessed with that relationship. Whereas in A Fraction of the Whole, it is interesting. It's riveting because they're unusual characters. Funny things happen. There are fresh ideas in it that I've never read anywhere before or since. The whole idea of selling a town as a tourist venue for being the worst place to live in Australia. You know, a suggestion box in this town that was supposed to bring the community together and ended up tearing it apart and resulting in its destruction. You know, the fact that this guy's father was a little bit mad, but not mad enough for anybody else to really do anything about it. Builds a house in the middle of a maze because he's so concerned with his privacy that he tries to make it impossible for anyone, including people who live there, to actually get to the house. You know, it's all of these bizarre things that are still very believable in a normal life. It's not fantasy, but these are eccentric characters doing entirely believable things for them. And the fact that the narrative voices in the novel are so natural that I think that Steve Taltz allowed his characters to be funny and be who they are, as opposed to other books, when you're reading fiction, it's like the author is trying to be funny.
Mm.
And that's where that distance comes in. But in this, I was right there with them. And I found the situations funny, but also sad. And if you can give me a book that's not only funny, but also sad, you have me.
Yeah.
Okay. When was that released?
It was out in about 2008, I think, and it was nominated for the Booker. Mm. But I never hear anybody talking about it
now.
I have to be honest, I think I've got a copy at home on the shelf that I've never actually read because it was one of those I picked up at the time or got given a copy and it sat there. And do you know what? I never realised it was a funny book.
Plus, I love Australian fiction. They have a really quirky sense of humour, so I can...
I think you're right there with them in an awful lot of the settings because they are unusual but very well drawn. A lot of it is set in this town, the worst place to live in Australia, which was a town that was built around a prison.
Mm.
You know, so you and then you have these awkward family relationships and in a kind of a Forrest Gumpy sense as well, a lot of the characters become famous for ridiculous reasons, but somebody becomes the most loved man in Australia and then shortly afterwards the most hated man in Australia and then somebody else is the richest woman in Australia, and they have all of these superlatives, you know, to define them, but it's a real roller coaster because for every time they're up they're back down again. And yeah, it's just, it's unusual and it's fresh. I've never read a book like that before or since, and I think that's why I like it so much.
Right, well, I've got to get myself, can you order me a copy of that, Bob?
There we are, we're on. We're
well,
on.
You need two copies.
There
because
we are, we're just all rolling.
Because the last person who borrowed it from me never gave it back.
At least we know it wasn't me.
Okay, so that's a fraction of the whole Stephen Toltz.
Steve Toltz.
Steve Toltz, that's right.
T-O-L-T-Z, I think. Or, yes. No, T-O-L-Z, or...
T-O-L-Z, I think, as well.
But
that's what Google's there for.
Yeah.
There we are. Book two in your list for trilogy.
Yeah, book two is nonfiction, which is extremely unusual for me because I am normally just a fiction fan. I don't read nonfiction. But it's David Sedaris, who is a master and God when it comes to the personal essay, as far as I'm concerned. And I think about David Sedaris a lot now because the personal essay has become such a thing. And when you think of the whole millennial phenomenon of personal essays and everything on the internet becoming confessional, it's something I talk about on the blog a bit because I don't blog about my personal life. I don't mention anything except obviously I have opinions and they're there. But it's this constant draw to be confessional and to tell people things about you in order to draw them into your writing. So the personal essay is huge, and there's an awful lot of publishing going on there when you think of Lena Dunham and the whole, you know, and the way that they treat that in Girls. As far as I'm concerned, there is only one, and that's David Sedaris, and he was doing it long before anybody else.
And which one of his have you picked?
It's one of his earliest. It's Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim. And the reason that I picked this one is because I will read his shopping lists. I don't care what he writes, I'll read it. But Dress Your Family, there's a very... very sentimental but also raw core to it that I'm not sure came into the rest of it.
Like, that's right. I can't remember if it was his second. It certainly seemed to be the second most autobiographical one that I remember, because Me Talk Pretty One Day was pretty much lauded as straight biography, although, as you say, it's more personal essay and things. This is very much about his family.
It is.
And I know... further than that, after that, he kind of he had to back off his family slightly because I think this was a bit too raw for some of them. But it is one of the funniest books I've ever read.
It's so funny. And then again, this is my thing when it can be funny and sad at the same time, because my favorite essay in this is an essay in which he discusses something that happened to his favorite sister, Lisa. And you can tell that she's his favourite. I mean, you never say it, but everybody knows.
I was going to say straight away, the favourites.
So he comes from this big Greek family from North Carolina. And his sister is Amy Sedaris, the actress. So they were very creative in a lot of ways. But his father worked for IBM. So the way that he talks about them, they seem to be a completely normal family, but I think what he does very well is that he shows you that every single family is extraordinary in its own way. If somebody was to look very deeply at your family, no matter who you are, they'll find some very bizarre things. And he brings that out. But in his story about his sister Lisa, something happens to her which is tragic. He doesn't fully tell us what it is, but we know that it involves a dog and an accident and possibly a death. And she begs him not to write about it because he's practically taking out the pen as she's telling him about it. And then she swears at him saying, you cannot tell anybody about this. But instead of telling us what happened, he turns it into an essay about what it's like to write about your family and the rawness of that and how you're actually affecting other people. So it's very, very funny. But then at the end, the last paragraph actually brings tears to my eyes every time I read it. Mm-hmm. And then that essay in it is followed by one of the funniest things he's ever written, which is 6 to 8 Black Men, which is a, it's not a personal essay, but it's just a discussion of Christmas traditions around the world and how you don't even think about how incredibly weird they are until somebody sits down and tries to explain it to you. And the reference to 6 to 8 Black Men is about the Netherlands, where they have, you know, this quite scary Santa figure.
Yes.
Yes, a scary man who will come to your house in the middle of the night, and if you've been good, he will leave you some presents. But if you've been bad, he has 6 to 8 black men who come with him. And they're very specific. It's 6 to 8. It's not 7. It's not 6. It's 8. And if you've been bad, they will put you in a sack and kick you.
And right. Yes,
this is one of those Christmas traditions that we let go.
So I must take that up in Bleach House.
Yeah, and there's a similar figure in Austria that a lot of these figures in children's legends are actually really scary, and he brings it out really well. But the whole thing is hilarious.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's very, very funny, but he also brings out that very bittersweet truth of, if you're going to write about yourself, there are consequences. And sometimes I get very, I don't know, uncomfortable when I'm reading more modern personal essays where people are ripping themselves apart just to try and get read, I think. And it's like they're reaching for your attention, but you know, you feel, I don't really have the right to know this, and I'm not very comfortable that you're telling me this.
I also think as well, this sounds as if there's a great mixture, whereas there's only so many personal essays that you can read about the heaviness that people are carrying around in them. It's nice to also know that there's humor mixed in with that. So that's,
yeah, and you see, he doesn't write about necessarily depression, or he does the other time. There were a couple of tragedies in his family, but he's really milking the comedy out of his family, you know, because they are hilarious.
Yeah. Mm.
And there's brilliant stories there. But I don't think, unless you sit down and try and write something about yourself, you have no idea how hard it is to do that with a lightness of touch that will make people laugh, not uncomfortable, and yet also not do detriment to the people that you're writing about either.
On the lighter side, I think Marion Keyes does it very well. You know, actually, you know, even the words lighter side, I think it's quite unfair to always put Marion down as being light. I mean, her essays last year were great. You know, they were absolutely great, a great balance. And I think good editing is important. As you said, one story that had you crying, the next one was hilarious. Mm. It's important not to have
I think we sometimes always do that thing. If it's funny, it's light. And actually what Marion Keyes can do and David Sedaris can do in completely different ways. But Stephen Toltz, as you were saying, can do is you can be heavy and funny.
Yep.
You know, that actually it's an art in itself to do that. You can sort of look at
things. I thought A.A. Gill was wonderful at that as well, you know.
And I think it suits us as well, particularly Irish and English people. We tend to have a black sense of humour, you know, where you have this black comedy thing that we use sometimes as a defence mechanism, but sometimes it's just there, that you need to laugh at some of the terrible things that happen sometimes because they are surreally funny. You know, so if you can mix that funny with sad, then, you know, I'm your fan for life. But sometimes fiction tries too hard, and then I find myself standing back from it and shaking my head going, is it just me or is this not funny?
And in my own way, I have to mention, I think David Sedaris's diaries were published last month, which was his kind of new book, which again, not had a chance to read, sitting in my huge towering pile of books at home.
Saying, read me.
I am a huge David Sedaris fan. And one of my almost highlights was meeting him at the Edinburgh Festival.
I'm so
jealous. About 4 years
Tara
ago.
Has and just he hit
came
the
over,
floor.
He came over, he did an event in Ireland, I think at Listowel, at the Listowel Festival. And I couldn't go because we were actually away at that point, and I was devastated because I love him. And then I was going out to visit friends in Edinburgh and coincidentally just arranged a visit to tie in with his appearance at the Edinburgh Festival. And he was everything you would hope and more, to the state that he turned around to me and said, you know, where are you from? And I said, oh, we're from Dublin in Ireland. And he said, do you know Margaret? And do you know what? I did know Margaret. And that was one of the highlights. I was like, Margaret from Hachette? Yes, I do know Margaret.
Yeah.
And that was it. And we were off talking about Margaret.
Not this so Margaret. It's okay.
Exactly.
He didn't know who
Margaret.
I was.
Yeah. He's so funny in person as well, though, when interviewed. And he narrates his own books. And this is another way that I buy David Starr's, because I'll buy him in print, but I'll also buy him in audio form. Mm. And he was the first author that I ever listened to in the car.
Yeah.
You know, so I'll buy the Audible formats of his as well, because you just want, you'll get something completely different from listening to him narrate than you will from reading him on
I
the page.
I love an audiobook where the author is narrating it. It just gives it that slight edge.
And I think there's various, I think he's done podcasts of his own, part of New York as well, but also there's plenty of stuff up online if you just want to hear David Starr's talk about anything.
My recommendation would be to go, there's a clip on YouTube of him reading Six to Eight Black Men.
Yeah, you were showing me that recently.
So that's a good place to start.
So that's number two, Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim by David Sedaris. And so the final shot at trilogy, book number three.
Book number three is Jeanette Winterson, Written on the Body.
Okay.
And the reason that I selected this it was serendipitous for a start, because I had it in my hands last night and I couldn't decide. And then this morning I woke up and realised that she had a piece in The Guardian and I thought, it's fate.
Okay.
So the reason I selected it was because I first read this when I was about 19. And sometimes things that you read when you're younger, you do change your opinion and they don't speak to you in the same way when you're older. But for me, this book has stood the test of time, because I think that she found a new way to write about love, which is not easy considering everything that has been written about love in the last, you know, 1,000 years. It's a love story between the narrator, who is never identified either by name or by gender. But I think everybody reads the book and comes out at the end and says, you know, they are absolutely definite about what the gender of the narrator is. And it's a love story between this narrator and a woman called Louise, who is married, and they have a very passionate and torrid affair. And I won't say any more than that, because it's literary fiction, but it's not that there's a huge plot in it, but the main thing that happens is also the thing that I wouldn't want to go into it knowing about. But when I reread it recently, I was surprised. I really thought that I wouldn't think the same as I did when I was 19, you know, because I think when you're that age, you're in love with love. And, you know, the more tragic or the more forbidden or torrid, the better. But there are truisms, I think, that she has in there that still work today. And I was shocked, because I really thought that I'd be looking back on my 19-year-old self thinking, ah, sure, yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, back when you know nothing and you know, before you got more cynical about things. I really didn't think that the prose would speak to me in the same way. And yet it did, because there are lines in there that she's written that just strike you as all encompassing, that she'll say something and you go, yes, I think that too. And I didn't know that until now. So yeah, it's shocking to read something 20 years later and realize that it's still as good.
Yeah.
Because you think you'll have changed more.
I was going to say, and I think sometimes when you revisit a book, as you say, it's a completely different book than the one that you remember. So to find
a book, you're a completely different person.
Exactly.
So you're afraid, but by the sounds of that, the words transferred over regardless of who the person is that's reading it.
Yeah, and especially because I remember I read it in college and everybody was reading it
at
the same time.
And you're all angsty.
Oh, we were
19.
All angsty and everyone was saying, have you read Written on the Body? And we were all passing it around. And actually, do you know what? Maybe somebody lent that to me when I was 19 and I never gave it back. So I don't know. But, you know, we were all passing it around and people having huge discussions over, you know, over gender and, you know, the whole idea of, was it, you know, is it a fair between two women and that sort of thing. And just wondering about the feeling and
or will I ever feel love that passionately when you're that young?
Will I ever have that passion? But as well, it was kind of the time where you felt like if you found a partner who also read it and liked it, then it was true love. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I want us to like the same things, you know, before you realise that opposites attracting is not actually a bad thing.
Yeah.
So, so we were all reading it at the time and it felt very zeitgeisty and it was, you know, it was just the topic of the day and, you know, you had to read it. So I really was shocked to read it again and find that I didn't look down on myself reading it.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Sometimes you dread rereading something because you think it's going to ruin the whole thing for you.
And yeah, it'll ruin the memory.
In our grown-up, yeah. disillusioned way.
Yeah.
We won't. So it's fantastic when you find a book like that, you read it and go, actually, that's really good.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm like that with Judy Blume. I know it's only for children, but yeah. I'm like that. I still read her and I still love every word. It's great to find something that you can reconnect with.
You know, I've got so cynical, which is why I write satire now, you know, over the years, that it's nice to know that that part of you didn't die, you know, and that there's still some hope for you, that you can still like a book which is about love.
Mm.
You know, and it's genderless and it's sexless and it's a universal romantic love, but it's just nice to know.
It's not pretending to carry a message.
No, it's not.
Yeah, and sometimes books that are pretending to carry a message can be quite exhausting.
Yeah.
You feel if you don't agree with the message that it's supposedly giving you, that you're wrong.
Yeah.
So it's nice to know that one doesn't do that.
Yeah, so my cold, you know, my cold heart isn't dead yet.
Well, that's
and
good.
This book is my
exactly.
evidence.
Exactly, there We're you are. Really it gives it a little warming up now and again.
Yeah, so even though I currently have a copy, if I lend it again, I'm definitely taking it back to remind myself as I walk past my bookshelf that I still have a heart.
Well, thank you, Tara. Thank you for joining us for our trilogy slot today. So our guest was Tara Sparling, a writer and a blogger. You can catch up with Tara online at tarasparlingwrites.com. And just a quick run through again, Tara, of the three titles of the books you picked today.
A Fraction of the Whole by Steve Tultz, Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim by David Sedaris, and Written on the Body from Jeanette Winterson.
Fantastic. Thank you yet again for joining us. So you're listening to The Bookish Podcast, a podcast coming to you from the Head Stuff Podcast Network, where we talk all about book-related things from the studio here in Dublin in Ireland. My name is Bob Johnston from the Gutter Bookshop.
I'm Margaret Madden from bleachhouselibrary.ie.
So just a couple more things to cover on this month's Bookish Podcast. We'll do a very quick second look at about an old forgotten classic. We'll do a quick roundup of some new books coming your way over the next month, of things we're particularly looking forward to. And then we'll just do a final little section on any events that have caught our eyes that may be of interest to you. So I picked out a book for our second look this month, and I actually picked out a book that I have not read, in a way similar to what Tara was saying about her Jeanette Winterson, since I was a teenager. And it's actually a book I picked up in a charity shop. I own a bookshop. I still pick up books from charity shops because sometimes, you know, you can't buy everything that you want.
It's always when you're dropping stuff in to clear out.
Yeah,
and you just find
and you just accumulate and bring it back. And I saw a copy of The Chocolate War by Robert Cormier. Which, do you know, when you get asked, is like, what books do you absolutely adore as a child, or what books do you always stuck with? And this is a book that always stuck with me. And people would say, what did you love? You know, and you go, oh God, The Chocolate War by Robert Cormier. And I was like, I can't actually remember what this book is about, why I loved it so much, why it stuck in my head as a book that I really should be reading. And I thought, you know, I'm just going to go and read it again to see actually why I keep saying this book stuck with me. So ostensibly, it's a book about, it's set in an American high school. And basically, it's a charity fundraiser each year. They sell boxes of chocolates to friends and family, one of those things. And the money goes back into the school to support.
So it's a bit like the Girl Guide Cookies thing.
Exactly, okay. Like the Girl Guide Cookies thing or any other kind of school fundraiser. Yeah. Certainly, when I was growing up in England, we had to sell raffle tickets every year, and the pressure was on to sell them to all your aunties and uncles and your neighbours, and you had your books and you had to.
We had, do you want to buy a line?
Buy a line.
You had to buy a line. You had to put your name on the line.
I was getting very concerned for your upbringing there for a minute, Margaret. So basically this is what the Chocolate War begins at. So basically what's happened is the headmaster has gone away on sick leave and the deputy headmaster wants to make a name for himself. So he's upped the ante. So they all have to sell twice as many chocolates as they've ever sold before at a higher price because he's done a special deal with these chocolates that are going out of date, blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
So, you know, this is where it begins. But interestingly, what comes into it is very much around the cliques of high school or upper school, as we used to call it when we're going to community college or whatever, about whether you belong or not, whether you're in with the in crowd, whether you do what you're supposed to do. So there's a gang in this school called the Vigils who set up almost like dares. So to become part of the Vigils, you have to do what the Vigils say. So they tell people, you know, whether it's unscrewing every bit of furniture in a single room so that it all collapses when anybody comes into the room, etc., etc. So there's all this undercurrent of stuff going on. But the stuff I hadn't remembered about the Chocolate War was the writing style. It's full on out there, quite experimental, quite different. And it's funny reading it now as an adult going, God, this is very complicated. God, this is more, you know, this is more than I ever remember dealing with.
So when you were reading as a teenager, you weren't picking that up at all.
And I think, you know, you take almost your books you read as a teen as easy readers.
Yeah.
And this was one of the most challenging books that I've read this year in terms of style, in terms of content. And without being funny, there's no happy ending. You know, it doesn't end well, and it doesn't end as we would all hope a teen or a child book would, to say it all turned out okay in the end.
And yet it's one that it stayed doesn't. With you all this
and
time.
And I think that's maybe one of the things that stayed with me, is that life doesn't always turn out like a book, even when it's written in a book. You know, is actually, it doesn't turn out like the good guys don't always win. And what does that mean? And I think we learn a lot as kids about the way life does. Now, to say that, it's pessimistic in some ways, but it's not a book that would make you kind of go, it's all pointless, why do I bother? But it's a hard lesson in life, I think. And I think sometimes you need to hear that as a kid. And I think sometimes it brings it back into you as well, that you kind of go, I'm not going to win every fight. I'm not going to win everything.
And do you think if it was out now that it would be a YA book? Would it come with a trigger warning per article?
It's definitely a YA book. Okay. It's definitely for teenagers. It's complex. It's uncompromising. And it's certainly one, having reread it again as an adult now, I will be off pushing it on to people and to teenagers to read again.
Yeah.
But also adults to read. Because I think sometimes we're all too happy with a happy ending, and I believe at the time it was quite controversial, because obviously books for teenagers were supposed to tell you it's all going to be okay, and this refuses to pander to that, and I think that's kind of an important lesson itself. So that was my second pick. That was my look back for this month. That's The Chocolate War by Robert Cormier. So we're coming into the end run, shall we say, of our first relaunch of Bookish with the Podcast Network. So we're going to look at a few of the new books that are coming up this month. Margaret, what do you have for us?
Right, well, I can't even tell you that much about what they're about, because they've basically just landed. That's like yourself, I get advanced copies about what's coming up next to see what we think of them. And the first one I have here in the pile is Roddy Doyle. And it's called Smile. Now, I'm as blind as a bat. I'm trying to hold it out, even though I have glasses here. It's ridiculous. I don't know. I've heard some people say, ironically, just what you've just talked about, the ending confused them, that they don't really know how it ended. And I'm looking forward to that.
Yes.
I don't necessarily want a big bow at the end of a book, like you just said earlier. So I'm looking forward to getting into this one.
Yeah.
And I mean it's Roddy Doyle.
A new adult novel from Roddy Doyle is something that we're going to get excited about.
And I absolutely love his writing style, no matter what way he does it, whether he does it from a humorous way, from a child's point of view, from an adult's point of view, from a dark way. His wording is wonderful. I haven't read any bad Roddy Doyle, so we'll see how this one goes. So that's my first.
Do you remember when that's out? I think it's out.
These are all out
August.
Smile is the 31st of August.
Very end of August. Mm. So we're just at the end of July with this podcast, and so we're waiting a month for.
But I would imagine you're going to see this in all the newspapers now for the next couple of weeks.
Exactly.
So it'd be nice to give a name out there.
So one we're looking forward to. That's Smile by Roddy Doyle.
Mm-hmm.
What else we got?
I have The Scandal by Frederick Backman. Now, everybody knows of a book he wrote previously called A Man Called Ove.
Yes.
So this is the next one. And This one is out on the 10th of August, so not too far away. And it's another small town kind of look. And his writing is very, very easy. Well, his previous ones anyway. I haven't started this one yet, obviously. So I look forward to getting stuck into that one.
A Man Called Ove was one of those. I've actually done it with a couple of book clubs. It's a good book club. And I think the movie's just out. And I think he's up for an Oscar, the movie, wasn't it?
But it's one of these ones where everybody's like, oh my God, it's my book of the year. It's my book of the year. So it seems like it's an easy enough read as well, that it's reaching to all different types of readers. So hopefully this one will be just as good.
Good. One of the first ones I picked out, there's a new book by Bernard McLaverty, a Northern Irish writer, called Midwinter Break. And it always feels funny to be in a hot room in the middle of July talking about Midwinter Break.
Yeah.
But this is out. It's coming out 3rd of August, which seems interesting for me because obviously most of the big hitters will be coming out September, October. Mm-hmm. But this is, I got an early read of this and thoroughly enjoyed it. It really reminded me of, there was a film out a couple of years ago called, I think it was called Le Weekend, which is about an older couple who go over to Paris.
Oh yes, loved that movie. So,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it's kind of quite difficult in places. And this is similar. This Midwinter Break, this similar thing. It's an old couple, or an older couple. They're not that old, older. And they go off to Amsterdam for a midwinter break. So I think it's January, I think it's set in. And it's about their relationship and about how they have progressed through life and where they are individually. I love Bernard McLaverty's writing.
Is it a long one?
No, it's not over long. It's about 300 pages, I think. Okay. It's not packed with action. It's more about relationships. So it's slow moving, but it's beautifully written. He wrote Grace Notes, which is one of my all time favorite books. Mm. Love Grace Notes. And it's always a pleasure to see. It's been a while since we had a novel from him. So I'm looking forward to that one. And then one of my other ones is Tin Man by Sarah Winman, which I cannot telling everybody about. It was actually released today, 27th of July, the day we were recording this podcast. So it was out in all the bookshops now. It is the most beautiful book that I read this year. She wrote a book called When God Was a Rabbit.
Oh, I absolutely love that. And my daughter did too, yeah.
Yeah, which I must admit, I've never read this first one of hers that I've ever read. And I now want to go back and read all of her books. Stunning writing. And this is just a stunning story. It's set in Oxford in the UK. And it's the story of two men, Ellis and Michael, and a woman called Annie that comes into their lives. Ellis and Michael grow up together, basically, in Oxford, and it follows their friendship through a number of years. Really simple read, really easy to read, but my God, it's beautiful.
Powerful.
Absolutely powerful.
And is that out next week? Is it?
No, it's literally hit shops today, 27th of July. So it's a little yellow hardback in Ireland. Not overly expensive, not overly long. It's literally, I think, 180 pages, something like that. But it is the one for the next month. I will just be saying, everybody that comes in the shop is, buy it, read that. And I keep doing it at home anyway. I've made everybody I know read it because I just think it's a stunning book.
Right, that sounds like I might have to stop off on the way home and buy a copy of that then.
There you are. What else you got there? We see another one on the table.
Yeah, this is already causing a huge storm, and it's not out till the 29th of August, I see here, but this is a quote on the front from Stephen King. The word masterpiece has been cheapened by too many blurbs, but my absolute darling absolutely is one. And this is a book called My Absolute Darling by Gabrielle Tallent. Mm. Basically, I won't read the whole blurb, but at 14, Turtle Alveston knows the use of every gun on her wall and that her daddy loves her more than anything else in this world. She also knows that chaos is coming and only the strong will survive it.
Yes, yeah. It's one of those I really want to read. I kind of dread reading.
Yes.
Here it is. Harrowing at points.
Yes.
But I've also heard that it's fantastic. And again, I saw a tweet by Stephen King, I think, yesterday.
Yeah. And I mean, for him to say a masterpiece.
This book, you have to read this book. Yeah, so it's one of those books I'm really looking forward to, but really dreading.
I have seen a bit of chat about it already on Twitter, and where people, after two chapters, are saying they have to put it down, that it's a real difficult. I don't know whether they mean, that's why I haven't researched it too much. I don't know whether they mean difficult, harrowing, upsetting, graphic. I'm not sure, but it's going to be, I think it's going to be huge. So that's probably what I'm going to get stuck into next. And I'll let you know whether I'm harrowed or upset.
Well, I just have two other quick mentions, both books that I'm looking forward to, but haven't even had a chance to look at yet. A book called The Locals by Jonathan Dee, which is out on the 10th of August. Jonathan Dee is he's kind of one of those writers that has never hit the big time, as far as I'm aware, certainly not in Ireland as yet. He wrote books called Palladio and The Privileges, both of which were critically acclaimed.
Loved The Privileges.
But I've never actually read him. But this one sounds fantastic. So basically, and see if you get any idea of where this might be going. A rural working class New England town elects a hedge fund millionaire as their mayor. Mark Firth is a home builder in Howland, Massachusetts, who, after being swindled by a financial advisor, feels opportunity passing him and his family by. It's the collision of these two men's very different worlds that kind of brings the outcome of the novel. So certainly something to say about current times and where we put power and who owns what and who owns power. So I'm really looking forward to that one. And the other one is a book called Christadora by Tim Murphy, which came out last year in a hardback or large paperback format in Ireland, which is just coming into a small paperback here on the 9th of August. It's basically the story of a diverse set of characters set in New York in the East Village. Christadora is the name of the building that they live in. And it's about the response to the AIDS epidemic in New York in the 1980s. I have heard it is a fantastic read. And again, it's one I've got sat in a big pile at home that I've never got to. And now it's coming out in paperback. I'm so far behind the times. But it's one I think is really... I think it's one of those that got overlooked, that hasn't done what
it should
do. I
was just
going
to say, it's not something I've heard.
And... you know, merits more attention. Mm. So, yeah, looking forward to that Christadora, Tim Murphy, on the 9th of August.
Yeah, that sounds great. You know, reading recently the Vincent Hanley piece, and I think it was in the Irish Times, and looking back at that era, it's not something that's written about in fiction, I think, that much. Or if it is, I'm not coming across it. So I'd be really interested to see what you think of that one.
Wonderful. So there are new picks for August time coming up, ones that we're looking forward to. Finally, any kind of events, any happenings that particularly interest you or that, you know, you feel worthy of mentioning?
Well, I think this time of the year, I mean, there's literary festivals all the time running in Ireland, but a lot of them at the moment are literary fiction literary festivals, if you get my meaning. Mm. And I'm going to pull back, I think, now till about October. Harrogate was great crack for me, and I'd find it hard to sit myself down at a very serious festival just now. I think I'll just sit back, and I think the Bray Festival is coming up soon. That sounds very interesting. That's a new approach. I just actually won't be able to make it. But yeah, I think it's great that there's going to be all different diverse kind of literary festivals now, as opposed to some of these are just quite arsey, and I don't feel comfortable at some of them.
Yes.
So it would be nice to see more reader-friendly ones.
Yes. Good crack. That's where you are. Who doesn't? There you are. Well, you mentioned it there. Yeah, the very first Bray Literary Festival, I think, 23rd and 24th of September in Bray in County Wicklow. So Alan McMonagall, Nuala O'Connor, Arlene Hunt, Louise Phillips, Sam Blake, the crime ladies are there, kids events, history, poetry. So it sounds like a good
great
one,
mix.
First one they've done.
Yeah.
So I think they're at brayliteraryfestival.wordpress.com. I'm interested in that one as well. See what they bring together. A kind of nice mix of local and bigger, I think. There is also, and this one wasn't even on my radar when I was looking around for things that were going on that might be interesting, and I might even have to pass this to you to say, because my English accent always gets in the way and my pronunciation of Irish place names is terrible. So it's the Town of Books Festival, and it's in Greignamanagh, County Kilkenny. That's as good as I do. Apologies.
I probably just did say
it sounds
same.
Good. There's a lot of letters in there. That's all I'm saying.
Well done, Bob.
So it's on the 25th, 26th, 27th of August. It wasn't on my radar at all, but it sounds like they're trying to build it into a thing. And it sounds good fun, actually. So basically, it's more based around bargain, rare and specialist books.
Oh, right. OK.
That they bring in booksellers from all over Ireland and the UK. Ooh. So it's more of a book selling fair almost. So you can find it online at greignamanagh townofbooks.com, or might be easy just to Google Town of Books Festival. Yeah. I decided, because I'm not going to spell it all out.
But I mean, what a beautiful place to have something, and in August, God, so the weather might be nice.
And then the only other thing I'm going to get a quick plug in for is for my own bookshop, obviously, at the Gutter Bookshop.
Because we'll let you.
What is it like? Why not? Yeah. Which is going to be fun for us in September. We're doing our very first play in the bookshop, which is something I've always wanted to do. No idea how it's going to work and what we're going to do it as. So it's part of the Dublin Fringe Festival. The play is called End Of, because it ties in with stories and books. It's called End Of, being produced by Sugarcoat Theatre in the bookshop. And it's running the 16th to the 24th of September. So basically the synopsis, as I've heard, I've not seen anything, I've been chatting to them, but basically best friends Siobhan and Drew know what to expect from a day's work in a bookshop, difficult customers, poor pay and bad prospects. I think I may need to edit this for them. Then a box arrives containing a bewildering object causing books to levitate and shelves to disappear. Ooh. They are plunged into a mystery that makes them question not just their friendship, but the very fate of the world. It's got visual illusions in it by an award-winning magician. It's a thought-provoking comedy about the very beginning and the very end of the world. I have no idea how this is going to work out.
This sounds like so much
crack.
But
it's going to be good fun. And tickets are on sale now at fringefest.com. So anybody who fancies coming to see a play in the Gutter Bookshop in September, you'd be more than welcome. I have no idea what's going to happen.
So this is immersive theatre, really, then? Is that what they call it? Where you're in and these books are going to be flying around your head, Bob?
Who knows what's going to happen? But, you know, it's always good to do something fun.
Are you getting a bit part?
I might have a walk on. No, yeah. All right. I'll be too busy trying to catch the flying shelves and things, I think, at this point. But there you are.
That sounds great.
So there we have it.
Yeah.
That is our bookish podcast. We're delighted to be back with you. Once again, you can listen online at the Head Stuff Podcast Network. That's at headstuff.org. You can subscribe to us on iTunes or on Andrew.
Yeah, Andrew would be very happy
to call it now, on iTunes or Android. We're very thankful for our guest, Tara Sparling, who joined us today for our trilogy spot. And so for this month, it's thank you for listening very much. My name's Bob Johnson from the Gutter Bookshop.
And I'm Margaret from bleachhouselibrary.ie. And you can get both of us on Twitter at Bookish Podcast. We'd like to have a little tweet conversation with you about books.
See you next month.
This podcast is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.